This is the Tame Aperture Podcast.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Do you read me, Hal? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Come on down and jump some of this shit.
You'll always have power. Sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Welcome to the Tame Aperture Podcast, where we talk about all things movies from first-time directors, indie films, art house, and much, much more. Today, we're diving into the 1978 classic The Deer Hunter. The IMDb logline sums it up pretty well. The lives of a group of friends are forever changed by the Vietnam War. That's very helpful, IMDb. I'm Alan Martindale, editor and filmmaker, and along for the ride, as always, is our fearless leader, Gabe Wienendahl, filmmaker, film instructor, and film evangelist. Gabe, I know you're excited.
Deer Hunter.
This is your shit. This is like your element.
Been waiting for this for a long time. You know, a lot of times we just do what Alan wants on this podcast.
As it should be.
Exactly.
I threw you a bone on this one.
Exactly. And rightfully so, he's right. But here's the thing. This is my element. 70s Americana film.
Gritty.
Long,
yeah.
For a lot of people, boring. But for me, I'm just sitting there loving every minute.
You love every second of it. And just based on our off mic discussion, it seems like you have an idea of what my thoughts are on this film. What would you guess?
I'm not going to put a rating on it, but it's not good.
Okay. Well, I'm going to surprise you on this one.
Okay. Well, then you're just lucky I didn't make you watch Heaven's Gate.
Yeah. Well, we did talk about maybe doing both of those.
Which is Michael Cimino's follow-up film to The Deer Hunter.
That was his follow-up?
Yes.
Okay. I haven't seen it. I haven't heard good things, though.
It's fine.
Well, anything he was going to follow up is not... I mean, this is The Deer Hunter. Like, this is has some of the most famous scenes in all of movie history.
And not only that, but we were talking, you know, you look at the, I mean, just to set it up for those that don't know, we got the Pantheon. We got the, maybe not, it's not the Mount Rushmore, but whatever you want to call it, they're putting statues up around the arena for the following actors. We got De Niro, we got Walken, and we got Streep.
I think Christopher Walken... And I'm not saying for not for people who would listen to this show who are movie enthusiasts, movie evangelists like yourself, like, but for the average person who enjoys films but doesn't really dive into it like we do, I think Christopher Walken gets a little bit of a raw deal because they think he's just the guy that talks weird, but he actually can act the shit out of any role he's in.
What's your best Walken in person?
That was it. I'm not doing it anymore. That was it.
That's the guy. I can't do it either. Damn it. I wish I could.
I wanted to do the Pulp Fiction thing where he had the watch. It was in his ass.
It is it. I can't do it.
Yeah, I can't do it.
Fuck, I wish I could.
But he really is. He's more than just a shtick. You know, like, he's more than just a very unique cadence. Like, he can act. Like, Seven Psychopaths. Him in Seven Psychopaths is pinnacle Christopher Walken.
Are you trying to deviate me from the Deer Hunter conversation?
I'm just
because
saying,
we know Martin McDonagh is my next in line.
I know, me too. I think he's the top for me right
he's
now.
He's great.
You haven't seen Severance. Holy shit, Christopher Walken in Severance. Like, the range. What I'm trying to say is
season one.
Okay, so you saw season
one. So I did see him, but I have not seen season two.
But his range, it's unbelievable. Like, he just, I don't know, man.
And, I mean, think of Catch Me If You Can. It's
right.
It's a Spielberg film.
Right.
With DiCaprio.
Right.
Walken is the best in the whole movie.
By far.
And DiCaprio's great. So Walken, yeah, I agree with you. I get where you're going with this. Which is basically, yeah, Walken is underestimated in his ability to act across the board. He gets chalked up to a good impersonation.
Right, exactly. And he's entertaining in everything he's in. Like, he's just going to grab you and bring you into whatever role he is. And I'll say this as well. I don't even think he and Meryl Streep, who I think Meryl Streep is one of the best actors of all time. Like, she is
unquestionable,
insanely talented. I don't even think they're on their top game in this one. I don't think they're in their prime yet.
I agree with that. Obviously, you're learning.
Right.
It's earlier on. However, they're so natural in front of the camera.
Yes.
I mean, I'm following along.
I am too.
So they don't have that captivating resonance that they might have later on in decades to come. But there's nothing there that goes, I'm not interested. There are people who get in front of the screen and you go, eh.
Yep.
Not interested. Like, it just isn't dragging me in or drawing me in.
Right.
But those two for sure. Even I agree with what you're saying. Like, developmentally, they're learning as actors. But they have such a strong resonance, and it sounds cheesy, but you as an actor in front of a camera, you can have an aura.
100%.
Now, De Niro, he's got the chops already.
For sure. He's seasoned at this point. And my point wasn't to diminish their roles or their performances. My point was to actually say, was to give them props because they are fantastic in this, and they're not even at their prime yet, was my point.
Yeah.
So, yes, this film, I think, is long, especially in the first act. But just barely. There's a reason why. There's a reason why.
It's nice to hear you say that.
And so, yeah, I would probably have trimmed it up a little bit, maybe taken off 20 minutes of the first, not even the first act, let's say the first third.
Well, the first 40, for those that haven't seen it, this will not be a spoiler, but the first 40 minutes is a wedding, essentially.
Yeah, it is. Here's what I was expecting. They're talking about the first third is basically them. They're living their lives. They're carefree. They're gamblers. They're just having fun. And it almost feels like Vietnam is just a fantasy for them because they're going to be going to Vietnam and they're going to, and knowing what we know now about Vietnam and how fucking awful it was and just what a, it's the worst of humanity was brought out in everybody in that conflict. But the way they're approaching it, like, yeah, we're going to go and we're going to, go do this. And we're just living carefree lives and we're going to be heroes. And you think that you're going to see them on the train and then maybe basic training like we always see in all these things and see the progression of them. But no, it fucking hard cuts to them in the river being captured, basically, and we'll talk about these famous scenes, but basically going right into that shit right after you see their carefree life and how they don't give a fuck. They're young, they're dumb, and they're just having a blast.
I mean, the opening is really slow.
It is.
But it does build around friends and camaraderie.
So and here's so, my question
like,
to you.
For me, like, if you're thinking about day-to-day life, it's just like, it's me and my buddies. We're just living life. One of them's getting married. We're congratulating him. Here we go. And there's nothing that's like jarring or alarming around it. It's like everything there, that's how it was. It felt good. It felt calm. It felt casual.
Right. Do you think they needed that full hour to establish that?
If we want to... So here's the thing. Everyone goes the first hour, which is basically what it is. And I go, they do.
Okay.
And the reason I say they do is because it makes those scenes later on even more impactful. It's like, I think we've gotten to a point where with film, you take the hour and you set up the hour to build this world that feels natural, it feels real, it feels authentic.
Yep.
And you turn it upside down.
Yeah.
And now everything you thought mattered, all the things that were happening before now have been transitioned and flipped. And that to me seems like the analogy for the war. Like everything up to that point, like culturally, in those decades in the late 60s, 70s, everything was turmoil. And like you had something living up to that dream. The 50s were a dream. The early 60s were a dream. JFK gets shot. We go to the war. America was in your crazy time during that. And so everything got upheavaled.
And I think this takes place in 1968, I think.
Yes.
And it was released in 78. So after the war's over.
10-year difference.
Yeah. But I agree. I don't want to nitpick because this is a classic and it's really good. But I think they could have trimmed 20 minutes out of it and still got the same message in that first third. Like, I just think we don't need that long in the wedding of them dancing. You know, like, I get it. I totally understand. I did like seeing them as friends. I love seeing that shit. I love seeing Fredo.
Yeah.
Who is, by the way, talk about good actors. John Cazale, I think is how you say his name, Cazale or Cazale. He was a fantastic actor. But I love seeing the friends together. And you can see the guys who are going to war, you can see in their attitude towards life. Like Robert De Niro, he's like, you got to be prepared, man. You got to be fucking prepared. Fredo shows up to hunt without boots, without a vest. You know, like, you can see the guys who would not be ready for that. And you also see, like, they're up in the mountains. They're up high. They're up in a high elevation. And the next thing you know, hard cut, they are literally underwater. Like, to me, there's so much subtext and so much metaphor going on here that it's almost too deep for my dumb brain to even comprehend everything that's going on.
It's interesting because this is where I'm going to dive in and try to get detailed and probably sound like an idiot.
I think this movie's begging for this kind of stuff, though. It's begging for people who really know it and love it to break it down. At least,
I mean, that's why I don't mind the first hour. And I get, here's the thing. Most people are going to hate the first hour because, and you're right. Like, editorially, we've been conditioned to be like, we don't need, like, if my kids now watched this.
Right.
10 minutes in, like, they would want a bullet to the head. No pun intended. Right. Already. See how I'm going in?
I love it.
So, but for me, it's different. And the reason it's different is because I'm such an... This is where the movie apologist is going to come out in me hardcore.
Okay.
Because American films of the 70s hit different.
Yes. There's no doubt about that.
They were made at a weird time, but also there was such a weird thing happening in Hollywood that people don't know. There was a lot of creative freedom. Studios were like, what do we do? Because in studios' minds, they're like, we're not getting the blockbuster. We're not making, there wasn't even a blockbuster. But they're right. Like, there's creative freedoms. You know, filmmakers weren't trying to really, like, comfort the audience.
It wasn't a time of summer blockbusters, you know? Like, that was not a thing yet. Yeah.
Didn't really exist. And also, in the world at the time, especially in places like America, it was like, well, we're in war. We're at war. Kids are dying. We're sending 18-year-olds off to a war we don't even understand.
Right.
We're just going to do it. And everyone goes, yay. And then later on, everyone goes, well, maybe we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
So it just feels like the films of that time were not really made to comfort people, but to present certain realities. Like, this is happening. This is real. And people up to that point, it almost felt like maybe they didn't know. These are not films of the 50s or 60s where it was structural and studio-like. It was like, hey, the apartment with Don Lemon.
Right.
And it's like, hey, here's the structure and the plot and the thing.
Right.
And the hey. And then all of a sudden, boom. And the apartment's probably not a good example for that.
Well, I think that era was all, that's what America was. That's what at least America perceived itself to be. It was just, you know, simple. We got a simple life. We have simple values. And then I don't know if it's just the Vietnam War or, you know, I wasn't alive during that time. So I really couldn't explain to you exactly all the different cultural factors. But,
well, I will say the apartment's probably not a good example. It is in terms of how the movie was made. But what the movie represents is a aspiring worker giving his bosses an apartment to have an affairs with other women. So whatever.
Okay, well, yeah, maybe that's not quite.
It's not quite going to represent the 50s, is it? I mean, you know what I mean.
Maybe. I mean, probably does.
Maybe it does, yeah. But it does, to your point, it has a different tone. The way it was made, the way it's presented, the way you look at it on screen, and ultimately there is a resolution and like a final say. It's like, oh, I get it. I understand what's happening, and I'm going to walk out the theater, and I'm going to be like, hey, okay. Well, guess what? 70s Americana did not do that.
Not at all.
Hey, guess what? These are the realities. This is... It's talking about moods, morality, damaged people from the inside. Like, it's talking about real issues that people were going through, and it's presenting them on screen. And that hits differently than the studio films from prior decades.
It does. I mean, you look at, I mean, this was 69, but Easy Rider, you look at Taxi Driver. Like, these are rough movies, man. These are tough to digest.
These are damaged individuals.
Yes.
From the inside.
Yes, absolutely.
And no one did that before. They didn't do that. They just were like, we're going to represent it from the surface level. And I guess that's what I love about some of these movies is they're just real raw and they're just internal. So,
and the flaws make them more endearing. The flaws that you see and just the look of them and the raw editing and it just...
Well, you say that as a filmmaker. I wonder how other people who don't interpret movies that way would feel because they've been conditioned to be polished and perfect.
Right, right.
Because I agree with you. I want a scene to unfold. I want it to hit beats but not feel plot-driven.
You want it to feel real.
It's this movie, by the way, Deer Hunter, is not driven by plot.
Not at all.
It's just like, here's beats and then the characters and then here we are and we're moving along. So it's a little bit broken. And I don't know that people will resonate in today's culture, at least, are going to resonate as strongly with that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I it almost lost me. It did. If it wasn't for Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken and Meryl Streep, I honestly would have been like, ugh, this, I can't take it.
But this is where, once again, we probably differ. And I love the awkwardness that's just left intact.
Right.
Like, if you're watching the movie, you're like, why is there a pause there? And why are they repeating the same thing? And why are they saying that? And it's like, oh, wait, that's how life is.
It is how life is.
And sometimes, not all the time, look, I'm all good for big block, but like sometimes when you're feeling something that's real and the topic that they're putting into this is a real conversation piece, let it be real. Don't polish it.
This movie needs it needs that. It needs the warts. It needs all of that stuff. If this was too polished, it would come off as disingenuous.
Yeah.
And you can't really have that in a movie that is about what this is about. I mean, it gets pretty fucking dark, dude. Like, it gets dark and tough to watch. Like, the hard cut to Vietnam, and they're forced to play Russian roulette. That is some of the most intense scenes, the Russian roulette scenes, that I've ever experienced watching a film.
I've seen this movie half a dozen times. Every time I watch that scene, I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I'm sad.
Yes.
And I'm depressed. Yes. And a lot of times movies don't know, even if they try for that, they can't make you feel that viscerally.
It doesn't work.
But every time I watch this and I'm watching Nick in the thing, when he's going through some kind of anxiety, obviously he's in a... I mean, can you think of it? Like, I think the way he represents it is so authentic that he, whatever he was trying to push for and convey, like, I think he got it.
He got it. You know? There is no doubt. Like, it doesn't, that intensity doesn't work. And this is where I'm with you. I'll give you this. It doesn't work without that first hour. Without that first third of the film, you're not feeling the weight of that. You may understand that it's a grave situation and it's dark and it's sad and depressing, but you're not feeling the full weight of what people felt about the Vietnam War at that time.
Yeah. And you're not feeling the three friends go through that trauma.
Yeah, Michael trying
to... like, because you have a first hour. That's the whole thing. The first hour builds up and you have Michael, Nick, and is it Steven?
Yeah.
And they're all best buds. And they and it's long. And I'll admit, there's moments where it can... I won't admit. It's not really it's not really boring for me. It almost feels so real, like it's like a documentary type. It's like cinema. It's not filmed that way.
Right.
But it feels so just kind of there and present that I just like, oh, I guess I'm just watching guys at a wedding getting drunk and yelling at people and thinking they're whatever it is.
Right. Well, I mean, there are moments there where it feels real, like when John Cazale, and I, again, if I'm screwing up his name, I apologize. I'm going to call him Fredo.
We'll call him Fredo for those that know The Godfather, but exactly. Stan is his name in this movie.
And he sees the wedding singer dancing with his girl and grabbing her ass, and you think he's going to go start shit with the wedding singer. But no, he goes up and he hits the girl. Like, what the fuck is that? Like, to me, immediately, I'm like, holy shit. Like,
welcome to the 60s.
That is insanity. And then she just gets up and she's like, you hit me. And he's like, oh, and he kisses her. And he's like, is that better? What the fuck? What is going on here? And I'm like, that's dark. Oh, God. No idea how dark it was about to get.
It's dark and then it gets darker. First off, let's just talk about Meryl Streep and Linda, her character, because at the very beginning of the film, mostly, she gets her ass beat by her father.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa, she's in a bad place.
Yes, she is.
Like, her dad's an ass.
Yeah.
And also, she's in a bad place. And then it just keeps getting... So there's these moments where you go... And I'm not justifying or condoning any of those
things. Of course not.
But, like, you start layering those things going, bad position, that sucked. Why are they doing that? Are people treating each other that way?
Yeah.
And then it keeps layering down until all the way you get from... this is going to sound bad. A small beating.
Right.
Watch the movie. You'll understand.
You're not saying it's good. It's
not,
just, yeah.
Not condoning it. Right. But like a small beating to murder.
Yes.
Like, so there's the steps. Walk to the basement.
Well, and think about this. Like, that is the quote unquote ideal world that they came from, was a place where women are getting beat regularly in public and nobody bats an eye. No one gives a shit. That's their ideal world. Like, think at how dark that Vietnam, everything they experienced there must be, if that's their ideal world, is Pittsburgh, the steel mills, the pollution, the dark. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Pittsburgh. It can get depressing at the right time
dingy,
of year.
It's dingy. It's dark.
Exactly.
And even in the opening shots of the film,
right?
It's like there's a trailer home behind a big a steel factory. And even at the beginning of the film, he takes like 5-10 minutes to establish the steel workers.
Yep. There's so much I know I don't understand, and I want to be able to understand it.
I don't know that I do either. I do know this, is that there was something, not growing up in a family of hunters, but now having married into one where my father-in-law is a hunter, they actually go out and it's ritualistic in the sense that it's almost spiritual. It's also like he says it, and we just watched the trailer before we started the podcast. I had to rewatch the trailer again, even though I've seen the movie many times. And he said, it's about one shot.
Yep.
You get one. And if you don't have another, it's gone. And you live with it and it's fine. But one shot, that's all it's about, is that one shot. The deer has to be taken in one shot. And they don't do anything that, like, represents, I don't think at least, negativity around killing the deer. They're going to, whatever it is, like, there's a level of respect there to what they're going about doing.
Right.
And the juxtaposition is now not just deer, but human beings. And it's not about one shot. Now we're going to play a game.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no...
That is interesting. You're right. You're right, because now it's about it's entertainment for the people around them.
There's not the same sanctity to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's human, like, life is nothing to them.
It means zero.
Yeah, it means nothing.
Because that scene where they're going through that and the recreation of just like the playing Russian roulette is like...
The whole thing just makes me feel so... I don't know. Gross isn't the right word. No, I don't know what the right word is.
Here's the thing about this movie that I feel like if people don't want to watch 3 hours of it, if you watch that scene where they're in the river with the three friends that they built that prior story around,
yep,
and they're having to play Russian roulette as POWs in a Vietnamese camp, it's pretty wild.
Well, and here's the thing. Even if you've never seen the film, you know this scene. Not just this one, but you this is very, very famous. I knew it. And so I thought I was prepared. I thought I was like, well, I know, I kind of know the basics of what's going to happen. Is they're going to be forced to play Russian roulette? And then it happens after an hour of seeing them in the real world and getting married and having a great time and seeing what their life is like. And now the stakes have been raised so fucking much.
Well, now it's life or death.
It is literally life or death. And it's not just with characters. It's with people I've spent an hour with. Mundane, like exciting, like all of that shit. That's why I say you had to have that in order to really feel the weight of what's happening right now.
Yes. There's different tiers of what I love about movies. Some movies are fun and entertaining, or if I go watch a family animated film, I love it. It's fun, it's engaging, there's a nice story, and it's heartfelt.
Right.
But there are other movies that tell stories in a deeper layer. And when you look at Deer Hunter, it's not just about Vietnam. So that at the level of that, it's like, is it just about Vietnam? No, it's not. It's about how violence can hollow humanity.
Very well said.
It's like there's a thing where it's like, oh, the violence is there, I don't care, and now I have no humanity.
And it's not just the people who experience the violence, whether they're perpetrating or being victims of it, it's the people around them as well, because you really do see how all of this shit has affected the people back home too. Which is something I was not expecting them to go into.
Yeah.
But they did a great job.
It's intense, dude. And that's what makes that scene so intense. It's not, I mean, obviously it's the fact that, you know, they're putting guns to their heads.
Right.
But it's also the full circle. It's the full cycle. Why is everybody doing that? And that's so deep that I don't have an answer to it either.
Yeah, like, that comes down to like propaganda, and you got to like dehumanize your enemy and all that stuff. But here's the thing, like it's so easy, and this is probably getting into a philosophical
This is why, sorry, I didn't want to get too deep, but what you have to say.
I mean, and feel free to cut this if it doesn't work, but it's so easy in 2026 where we're sitting right now to sit there and get on the internet and be fucking pissed off at someone because they did something or said something that we don't agree with and say horrible things, right? Like that's a very common thing. And we've all probably done it to some extent. And whether or not we regret doing that, it's up to each person. I do, the times I have, for sure. But if someone's in front of you, and I think this may be what you were trying to get at, someone's in front of you, and we're not just at a point where we're going to say terrible things to their face. We're going to fucking make them hold a gun and play Russian roulette. Like, you have lost that connection of humanity completely.
And gamble on it.
And gamble on it, exactly. Well, I don't know if you could do it if you're not gambling on it. But here's the thing, like, even after they get out of there, like, a lot of films would have just cut to them being back at camp or whatever, you know, or even back home. But this one, like, it tries to go through the escape, which is fucking harrowing. Like, it is. Dude, when Michael and Steven fell from the helicopter.
Oh, yeah.
My jaw literally dropped. Like, I was like, holy shit. what is happening? And then Steven breaks his legs. Like, the whole thing is just insane, dude. Like, it is, it goes from boring, mundane bullshit where you want to turn it off to, like, this is intense shit that I am not ready for right now.
And maybe that's the payoff he's going for. And that's why it took so long to get there.
I think so.
Because now you're really like, oh, shit, these are real individuals. And that's the thing. You're trying to make it as real as possible for the people who wouldn't have experienced it, including ourselves.
Right.
I've never been in war. I've never been in those situations. I've never, you know, like, he does do it as a movie. Granted, this is a movie. But he does put you in that predicament. And it took that long to get there.
It had to. It had to. I still would have cut off about 20 minutes. but it earned it. Let me put it that way. It earned the gravity of those situations.
Not to flip gears too quickly. One of the things I do also like about this film is how they portray individuals, specifically men. The reason I say that is because the men in this film, like Meryl Streep's character is great and you feel bad for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's actually really, she's the type of person you want to be around.
Yes.
You know what I mean? As a human being, you're like, this is the person I want to be around if you're trying to. They portray men. They're not really, though, like saviors. They're not like confused.
No.
They're not these, but I liked that. These are emotionally stunted. Individuals and they're whatever psychologically or spiritually lost.
Yep. Exactly.
And I kind of like that. They're not, what I mean is they're not cool. You know, who is it? Let's go Arnold Schwarzenegger or Bruce Willis.
You don't want to grow up to be these guys, basically. Like you.
Exactly.
They're living in their hometown they grew up in and they're working in a steel mill. And they're drunk as shit driving
they're
around.
They're not cool.
Right, exactly.
In these films.
Yep.
And they're quite broken.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so you don't want to be them. So they're not. But they're also, that's something that's real. It's like just meaning that like a lot of people feel that. They're just broken. They're just what it is. Right. So I kind of like how they portray that where they're not like machismo.
Yes. Yes.
They're doing things to survive.
Yep.
And they're dealing with the situations that were presented to them, which are shitty.
Right.
But they're not like saying, hey, the character doesn't come across as like, you know, machismo. Like this is how you need to be as a man.
Right. They're not romanticizing any of this.
Exactly.
Any sort of their characters, any sort of the actions. Like it's just.
And sometimes I like that. Look, everyone loves a good Die Hard movie.
Right. Of course.
I love Die Hard.
Who doesn't?
But like. That's not real. And sometimes it's nice to see, especially when you're portraying things that are affecting so many millions of people.
Right.
It's nice to see some semblance of reality.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. It was nice to see very flawed people. And like when Michael comes home and he's welcomed back as a hero, you know, he's not like, this is not a good, necessarily good or bad person. He's just a dude who was put in a fucked up situation.
He's also welcome back, and he hates every minute of it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So much so that when they're throwing a party for him, he doesn't arrive.
Yep.
He's like, he almost hates himself so much. That's how it's changed. Like, his character was like, you know, I don't want to be represented this way. This
right.
is not who I am.
Right. Right. But he does wear his uniform everywhere he goes.
That's true.
So it's...
maybe it's the...
There's so much shit going on
maybe
here.
Maybe it's the honor code.
We could literally start a brand new podcast and just dedicate it to everything about this film.
Well, I mean, there's so many... It's a three-hour-long film, and Cimino's got so many things happening here. America was questioning itself.
Yep. Yep.
And someone made a movie that also questioned America.
and
that's in the time that it's happening, to be able to do that in an art form is pretty crazy.
Especially for a film.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was because you think about it like World War II, World War I, America of the Good Guys.
Vietnam, Watergate, assassinations, economic anxiety.
Yep.
Because there's no gas or oil or whatever it is.
Yep.
And then someone made a film that played into all those anxieties and those things.
Yep.
Weird time, dude.
Very weird time.
And I'm not going to say that we're there, but 2025, as we're ending it out.
It resonates.
It resonates in some ways.
It hits
hard. It's a weird time.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is, Cimino, that's, how do you even make a movie to tell that story in that era the way he did about all the things that a country was feeling at that time? Anyway, just a lot of thoughts there.
Well,
that,
and there, I mean, it would have been so easy just to make a Vietnam movie, you know, like there's nothing wrong with, you know, Platoon and all those, like, there's nothing wrong with those. I'm not saying that, but it would have been easy just to be like, war is hell. War is awful, you know, but they chose to do it in such a unique way where that. You're not seeing the whole war. You are seeing one intense, sequence. And that's it. That's all you're seeing. And just that alone shows, like, you can understand why they are feeling. And you see the effect it has on them and the people back home.
That's the beauty, to me, of the film.
Yeah.
Is that you're taking singular characters. We'll call it Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken as the primaries. And then Meryl Streep as well. You're taking singular POVs, like points of view from them. But what's crazy about how he represents it is that a flood or a nation full of people could somehow relate
yes.
to some of the feelings that was being represented through the eyes of the three that he was representing.
Yes, exactly.
Which is crazy. Doing that while it was actually happening is even more crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very well done. So I didn't hate this movie nearly as bad as you thought I did. And as always, like, our discussion has made me appreciate it even more, which happens almost every single time we record a show. But I really did like. I did. It's a very, very well done, harrowing. I don't know another word than harrowing.
Now, spoiler alert. Walken, let's talk about, so if you pause it here, go watch the movie.
Yeah.
Nick kills himself. First off, Michael goes back and tries to look for Nick in Vietnam. Nick went AWOL
right.
and just stayed in Vietnam.
Right.
Because he had PTSD. He lost his mind.
I think none of them were ready or wanted to go home, quote unquote home. I think not necessarily they wanted to stay in war, but I don't think after everything they experienced, they were in any way, shape, or form prepared to go back to their regular lives. Steven even says it when Steven is in the hospital and he's had his legs amputated and Robert De Niro, Michael, is trying to take him home. And Steven says, I don't want to go home. Even though he's got a wife and a baby at home, he doesn't want to go home. Michael comes home and then goes back to Vietnam to find Nick, who is Christopher Walken's character. I think that's an easy out. Like that sounds crazy, but I think that's I don't think he wants to be home. I don't think he wants to be viewed as a hero, and I think he wants to fucking escape. And the only thing he knows anymore is what happened in Vietnam. That's my very uneducated theory on what happened.
I mean, I think that's a fair theory. Or does he care enough to have seen his friend Steven and it's a reminder for him to go, oh, whatever happened to Nick, and Nick needs to come home too. I don't know. There's just a lot of this is the thing about Vietnam that doesn't make sense, and I'm not a war historian. And that's where you can imagine those that went through the things they did.
Yeah.
It fucked with your brain.
Absolutely. This is just a fucking movie and it fucked with my brain. Like, this didn't even happen. But also, there was a point where Nick says to Michael, don't leave me there. Like, they're sitting on the basketball court after getting drunk at the wedding. And he's like, I love it here in Pittsburgh. He's like, I love it here. Like, when we're over there, just don't leave me there. So there's that. But I my theory is I think Michael wanted to escape, and I think he wanted to get as far away from possible, and so he went back to Vietnam.
And there's probably part of Michael. This is, once again, all, you know, we're just theorizing here. He probably went back to Vietnam and hoping that he might catch a bullet.
Yes.
And that's the darkness of the film. It's like he's going back going, you know what? I don't really care. And I hope that it's over. Yeah. And I might find a way to end it.
Yeah. And so do you think that's why Nick was disappeared and was entering all of these games? They call them games.
We already gave the spoiler alert, but that ending towards the end there, not the very ending, but towards the end, when he goes back and he's looking for Nick, he finds Nick, and Nick's just been playing Russian roulette for however long
for
time.
For money.
Yeah.
And he's sending all the money to Steven.
Yeah.
So he's not doing it for the money.
This is where I'm getting
Man, I feel like we need a.
This is where I need a therapist.
I think we need a psychiatrist in here to explain PTSD.
Good Lord,
it's absolutely insane. I mean,
Nick suffers. The reality is, we know Nick suffers. He ends up killing himself in Russian roulette, but it's because of severe PTSD.
Right, right. I mean, I'm not even going to try and assume what
it. Is it weird that it's Russian roulette? Because the movie starts with they show the origins of the families, and the families have Russian in like their lineage is Russian.
Yeah,
just saying this. It probably doesn't mean anything, but it's just
it
all
might.
Kind
it honestly,
of
it might. I mean, interesting. The levels of this film, like it probably does mean something. There's probably a reason why. There's probably subtext there that I would.
Yeah,
would never
I can't.
Understand.
I can't
I'm just
get
too
it.
Dumb.
I don't. I'm too dumb.
So, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind you love this film.
Well, I just think the last thing I want to say real quick about Nick is I think that he ultimately chooses death.
I agree.
He doesn't want to go back home. So even though Michael's there, and he's probably checked out somehow, mm-hmm. he'd rather die than go back to Pittsburgh.
And here's the interesting thing. Nick, who's Christopher Walken, has something to go home to. Steven has something to go home to. They like so. Nick has Linda.
Yeah.
And Steven has his wife and child. Whereas Michael has nothing to go home to. Basically, he doesn't have. But he is in love with Linda, which is a whole. I wasn't super into that
whole another storyline.
That one, like it felt unnecessary. But I don't know. I'm sure there's levels to that one as well. But to me, I could have done with that the love triangle thing. But it does show how loyal Michael was to Nick, so to go back and try and save him and bring him back. But that is interesting that the one person who didn't have anything at home did want to come home. Just more to it, man. More to ponder.
This is the deeper... This is what I'm saying. I'm going to wrap it up here in this sense, which is like, this is why I actually like... the 70s Americana films, because they give, there was no oversight.
Right.
I wasn't there, but it just feels like there wasn't studio executives going, oh, you didn't make this thing happen.
Can you imagine trying to make that shit now?
You can't do it.
You can't do it.
Not the way they did.
Right.
Not without like, notes.
It's too dark. Can we get rid of one of the Russian roulette
scenes,
please?
Your lines to editing 20 minutes off. They're not going to receive anything.
Right.
So I just love that. I think authenticity from that standpoint as a filmmaker, and I'm getting overly purist here, but like I love it. It's like this is someone's vision of like how they see things and how they want things to be portrayed. And it just feels like... In the 70s, you had that ability to do that. We do as independent filmmakers because no one watches our shit.
Right.
But like if you're doing a big studio film, can you imagine today trying to go, oh, I'm going to make a 3-hour film called Deer Hunter
and
do 1 hour of weddings? I mean, come on.
Two of the hours are going to be not even in Vietnam at all.
But here's the thing, and I'll just reiterate before we kind of get to the end here, is like, you're right. Like, that first hour is long, but it builds something to pay off later.
It does.
And I care about Nick and Michael more than I would have if we just give me 10 minutes of it that I didn't understand how those relationships really were.
True. True.
It's crazy.
The one thing I will say that I did not like, and I know a lot of people are going to disagree with me, I don't think you needed them singing God Bless America at the end. Like, I think the message was fine. Like, I get it. You didn't have to beat me over the head with it. You know, like, it's just those things where everyone starts singing together in any movie. I'm just like, oh, God. Like,
I wonder how much. Yeah, it's interesting, but here's where I'll differ. Because I do agree. Like, you're like, what? But I would just say that it's interesting to having gone through all this trauma, having no one really talk about it with each other.
Interesting.
And what I mean by that is, like, instead of like us sitting down and like fucking conversing,
right?
We're just gonna pretend that everything's fine.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, I see what you're saying.
So that part of it, having it there, kind of goes, well, that's weird because everyone went through shit. Like, you're just gonna just randomly overlook.
Right.
The idea that we're not going to talk about this shit?
Especially back then. I to me, that's a powerful message because no one talked about shit back then, man. No one did.
Yeah.
It was just, you're just going to shove it down
into
a ball.
Here's what's crazy in the tie-in today and why I think it relates to today, Alan. Because no one talks about shit today.
It's true.
And you know why? Now I'm going to sound like an 80-year-old man. We just go to electronics.
That's true.
No one talks. So anyway, I think that's the weirdness of it, is just that nobody, like, I get what you're saying. You probably could have cut that out. It's almost like Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
At the end when they start singing the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse song.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
I mean, that was kind of better, though.
That was better because it wasn't so...
Because of the juxtaposition of capitalism, exactly. And all the weird, you know. But the God Bless... I don't know. I probably wouldn't cut it, though.
I just wouldn't have done it, man.
Like, man, I'm glad you weren't a studio executive in 1978.
I would have fucked up so many movies. You have no idea.
I pulled up a thing here. They're all studio executives. I was reading an article. They're all studio executives. Didn't fully understand what they were funding. That's literally what it says.
That absolutely
And then
tracks.
It says, which meant directors had room to breathe. And so for me, that's the culmination of it. Like, I love that. Studio, here's the money. We don't know what we're doing.
Dude, like, it's... And here's the thing, man. Like,
That's New Hollywood.
I literally would have screwed up so many movies. Like, I would have made things so much worse. And so my opinion is just bullshit, but I definitely would have cut that.
It's not.
I'm kind of right on that one, but the rest I'm iffy.
I mean, look. Long, uncomfortable, indulgent choices.
Yes.
As a director. That's 30 plus minutes of a wedding. Long silences.
Very long silences.
But see, these are all things we're now conditioned to think don't work.
Yeah.
This is a conversation we had off air.
Right.
It's like...
This would have been... it would be interesting to have this conversation back in 1978 when this was released. Because now we are... Whether we like it or not, attention spans are shorter. And we quick cut, like, as an editor, I'm always, like, I tell people on my team all the time, fucking cut it. You got to go faster, man, faster. And that's,
you got to get the pacing quicker.
Exactly. And I believe that, but I also think that we're probably losing something with that because it.
Well, here's the thing. Times have changed. What do we do? Well, they're not advancing. Our constant mindset is like, how are we advancing the story or the plot? Whatever that is.
Right.
But how do we deepen the feeling? We don't think about that as much.
That's true.
And so today, you're right. We would just cut those instantly.
Yep. I would.
But here's my thing to modern studios, which I'll throw to you. You would cut those instantly. I'd say those are the things that exactly matter.
You're not wrong. But I just am thinking of my short attention span. And how I'm not able to
hold on. Don't advance the plot, deepen the emotion.
That I think that's a perfect way to put it. Should we read some Letterboxd reviews?
Please do.
There are so many reviews praising this film, so I only picked out bad ones.
I love it. I'll disagree with every single one of them.
Okay. And I didn't write down any of the names of the people who wrote it, so I apologize.
Bitch one.
Yeah, bitch one. Half star. Too long. Boring AF. here's a longer one. Half star. One of the worst movies I've ever seen. Was so excited to watch this. Vietnam movies are my favorite, but it's 3 hours of three stupid acts, with the second one being all right, but sandwiched between two slices of dog shit. Dialogue-y, spelled dialogue way wrong.
It's a t-shirt.
Yeah. Was absolutely terrible and made me so upset. Don't know how this is praised so well. Watched it on a flight and low-key wished the plane disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle so I wouldn't have to finish it. Wow, I was so disappointed. That's a good one. I like that.
Go write that movie.
No shit. Half star. Top three worst movies I've ever seen in my life, and it's not because I'm lacking any sort of media literacy. So many explanation points. Hated it, hated it, hated it. So many explanation points. And the last one, half star. This is my favorite. Suck that, punk. With the devil emoji.
Oh my gosh.
That's my favorite one.
They're all wrong, but that's fine.
They are all wrong.
Look, let me just respond to some of those things you just said. Okay. This film trusts time. Okay? The scenes unfold. They're not interested in hitting beats. They don't give a shit. Characters repeat themselves. It's authentic and real. And all the awkwardness is left intact intentionally.
Yep.
So, modern films, they're structural. We can follow them. Matter of fact, I'll lean over to my wife during a movie and tell her in 30 minutes what's going to happen.
It's true.
Because that's what they are.
Yep.
I couldn't do it with this film if it was playing now. And that's all I'm saying. Be open to the conversation. Make the pacing human and not algorithmic and move on. Thank you.
I think that's well said. To me, the real value, obviously artistically it's done well. There's a lot of value here. But the real value of this is I'm a history nerd. I like to go further back. So not, you know, way past Vietnam. I like World War II and before that. Like, so I love history. It's my favorite thing. But the thing that gets lost in history is how we feel, or is how people felt at the time when this shit was happening. Like, we can't really put ourselves in the place of someone who was in Nazi Germany or like in the Roman Empire, whatever it is, you know. It's really hard to do that. This movie stands a test of time because you watch this and you can imagine exactly what people were feeling when they were faced with the realities of the Vietnam War, let alone if they were there. So to me, this has got more cultural significance and artistic significance. To me, this is very, that's where this is really, really an important film.
I mean, I can't disagree.
And that may sound pretentious, and it probably is, but it's just, I was able to feel something. How often do you feel something new when you're watching a movie?
Well, I think it's not often. It's like I can almost understand to some degree what's going to happen. There's an expectation. There's a formula that happened sometime after the late 70s, early 80s, where it just turned into what we'll call the blockbuster. Yep. And structurally, they're still, I love those movies too.
Right, right.
I grew
There's
up
nothing
on
wrong
them.
With them.
I grew up on them. I love them. I talk about them all the time. I just wrote a movie about those movies.
Yes, you did.
But like, there's something about this type of movie that just doesn't get lined up today. And and it has to do with what you're alluding to, the cultural historical relevance.
It made me feel something I hadn't felt before, which does like, I don't, that doesn't happen anymore watching films. Like I'm at the same time, I'm bummed that I have not watched this before now, but also I'm glad that I got to experience it for the first time. So to me, that's really where I find the importance of this, because it really does put you in their shoes and makes you feel supremely uncomfortable. And that's just how people had to have felt back then. Like, so to me, that's the biggest important.
I think you nailed it here. It's library. We've talked about this before. Library of Congress. It added it to the National Film Registry in 1996. So that's rightfully for cultural so. And historical values.
It's not perfect. I still enjoyed it. I will watch it again. We talk about rewatchability all the time. I'm giving this 7.5 drowned rats.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about that.
Yeah, right? I was more worried about the snakes in the rivers than the rats. But the rats in the river were like, oh, dude.
Everything in the river.
Yeah, dude, it's like, it's
especially
scary.
When you have an open wound.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. So what did you go at?
7.5.
Drowned?
I'm going to go alive rats.
Yeah, because there's that moment where it shows the rat crawling in someone's head almost on the river there. It's pretty disturbing.
I'm going to go waterlogged rats.
Yes, that's better. just as a quick summary here, nominated for 9 Academy Awards, for whatever that's worth. It won 5. It did win Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor, Walken.
Good.
And Best Sound and Film Editing. So, Alan doesn't agree with the film editing.
How do you give it
for... Of course there's
editing. I can go along with these other Academy Awards, but for Best Editing, I might have to rewatch this and just pay attention to that, because... Man,
I think you should make a separate segment that's just about how Deer Hunter should not have won Best Editing Oscar.
Are you sure it wasn't for lack of editing? That one I can believe.
That's just you. Once again, this is, you're part of the Matrix. It's fine.
I am. I'm a huge part of the problem here.
You're part of the Matrix. You've just been developed to think that everything has to be fast and everything has to cut.
It's true.
You're the player, the opening movie of The Player. You ever seen that?
Yes, absolutely. That's me.
That's you.
I'd be like, I don't know, this shot's going on too long. Can we like spice it up a little bit?
Cut.
That's exactly me.
Which is ironic because it's coming from me, and I'm an editor, and that's what I do.
I know. So. But hey, at least I'm self-aware.
You gave it 7.5, waterlogged rats?
Yep.
Okay.
So stupid.
I mean, it's not. Once again, if you haven't seen the movie, you'll understand if you watch it. Trust me, you'll understand. That's a moment you'll understand.
Yeah.
The thing about The Deer Hunter is that it is obsessed with just mood. And as a filmmaker, like, that to me is really interesting.
Yeah.
And there's so many things going on. It's morality. It's damage to people. It's an homage to a time when people were able to go create films based on gut instinct and not think about what the repercussions were. In other words, oh, we have to do this. We have to try that. This is the plot device. And I think about it this way because, you know, years and years ago, like, film schools were, not that they weren't a thing, but there's a time in the 60s where it was like, well, they're just kind of a side note to a university.
Right.
And now they're quite a big piece to it, whether that's film or video or media. That all changed in the late 70s.
Yep.
And I always chalk it up to stuff like, obviously, Spielberg and Lucas. I mean, I used to teach classes and tell students, hey, y'all are here because of George Lucas, whether you like it or not.
It's true.
You know, whether you're thinking about just filmmaking or you're thinking about technology in filmmaking or you're thinking about whatever it is, you're kind of here for that.
Yep.
And what I love about Deer Hunter is it's kind of it's not that. It's just like pure storytelling with characters going through emotions and real things. And it's not about staging and developing plot lines that deliver structure.
No one was worried, like, are we going to miss this demographic?
Yeah.
It was not made by
not at all.
Formula or committee.
Yes. No, that's a good way to think about it. It's like it wasn't committee storytelling.
Right.
And not that that's bad. I actually think that works depending on what you're trying to say.
For sure.
So if you're developing a story around this or that, like, oh, that's cool. Let's get a good, you know, brain tank around how we're going to do that. But like, there are certain things that's like, I just need that individual's approach and what are they seeing and how am I going to ride that to the story?
Yep.
And I think that's what The Deer Hunter represents. Aside from all the other cultural, historical, dramatic, traumatic things that are presented. So I just love how it shows all that. I love how it shows the trauma of people going through a lot of shit without explaining it away.
Yeah. I love that. Is very well said.
They're just not, hey, we're not telling you.
This is just what it is. I love that.
We went through some shit and I don't have all the answers. And so I think that's interesting and important. So as you can tell, huge admiration for the film in general. I think everyone should watch it in some context, whether that's them, you know, what you were mentioning this before, but it's like, well, it has a lot of historical relevance. And people should go watch it for that. And there's a line in there where Robert De Niro, he says something alluding to the one shot to the
right,
deer.
Right. I think that's significant.
He gets the one shot and that's all you get. And if you miss it, you're not mad. You're not sad. You're just, you understand that that's what happens. And there's a respect to the deer and the deer gets to move on and it is what it is. Maybe I'm overthinking, but Vietnam was different. It's like
much different.
It's not one shot. It's not respect.
It's not
that
simple.
Mentioned this earlier. It's like recreation now in this to kill.
Yeah.
When he's deer hunting, it's not like he's out there trying. It's just a different analogy. And I'm not sure how to surmise it together, but I think there's something there. The deer hunt, it's one shot. It's deliberate. It's intentional for a reason. And Vietnam is endless shots with violence.
You know what? Something just occurred to me. In the deer hunt, you can plan. That's why he's yelling at Fredo, because Fredo didn't plan. You can't plan in Vietnam. So you can plan one shot and that's it, but that's not how it works when you're in a war. I'm a fucking genius.
Nailed it. 100%. So to bring it all together for my score, as you can see, I'm sitting here fawning over the film. And most people won't. Like, the reality is no one's going to watch this 3-hour film and be like, whoa.
There have been movies we've watched where I've been like, this is a classic? I don't get it. This one, there's a reason why this one is.
Good to hear.
We're not going to have to go to blows after this.
I mean, the log line in IMDb is sad.
Yeah. It's
the lives of a group of friends are forever changed by the Vietnam War, which is true, but it doesn't do justice to the film.
Exactly.
That's my point. It doesn't really give the layered context of what it is, nor should it, I guess. So I'm going to go in here, long story short, after I go off for 5 minutes about The Deer Hunter. I think it deserves every accolade that it gets. I don't say this about many films. There's only maybe one film that I've even put in this category. IMDb is at 8.1.
And Rotten Tomatoes, 86%. And audience is 91%.
That's where I'm kind of right there landing. I think this is such a quality. It's not, you know, I always talk about rewatchability. It's not like I'm going to sit here and watch The Deer Hunter.
It's your comfort
film. Yes. Every month. Hey, guys. You guys. Hey, kids. Gather around. Right?
It's that time of year again.
But there's a thing about filmmaking where I go, they nailed it. I'm going to go 9.2 red headbands.
Honestly, I thought you were going to go a little higher. You were almost talking like it was In Bruges territory.
I mean, the thing about In Bruges, now you can go with In Bruges, though, you can go to rewatchability.
Oh, yeah. I rewatched that movie.
Like, I'm not going to. Yeah, I do too. Yeah. And I'm not. And because it's funny and it's witty, yep, and it's dramatic.
It hits everything. Right.
And it hits all those things. But it's not this where it's so deep.
Right.
And layered that you're like, oh, man, okay. I'm going to watch that every month.
That's still. I'm trying to think the last time you given a movie that high of a score?
I'm looking for feeling. Yeah, like if I walk away, I just remember watching this a couple months ago and I wanted to do this earlier and I was like, this podcast, and I was like, oh shit, I forgot how good I feel sick to my stomach.
Yep.
I feel sad. I feel mad. I feel angry. Like all these things. And I'm like, why am I feeling this? Because it brought it out.
It's the power of cinema.
There it is.
It really is.
So 9.2 red headbands.
The average 2025 audience, I actually think if they can get past the first third. The
first hour?
Yeah. I really think that it would be pretty high ratings if no one had seen it before.
I mean, look, if you're waiting, here's the thing, and I'll give you a little secret. If you're looking to get through the first hour, right, before we get, you'll see Robert De Niro's dong.
That's true.
So there you go. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, at least at some point, I'm not going to tell you when, but at least at some point in that first hour, you're going to see a dong flying out.
That's true. Everyone, man, there's something that we've had a theme lately of dongs.
Not intentional.
Not intentionally. Or maybe it's subconscious.
Or maybe subconsciously it is.
It's not full on salt burn dong, but it's still pretty good.
Well, let's say dong and bush.
Dong and bush. Yes, exactly. I mean, I think we covered it. It's a good film. It's definitely, if you're a film head, you gotta see it.
You gotta see it. And that's our mission. If we caused you to go watch the film, then we won.
That's
even
true.
Even if you didn't
that's
listen true. To the podcast, which now is too late. So you listened, now go watch.
And that's, I mean, that's the thing. That's why we do this show, because it's cathartic for us to talk about movies. But honestly, like, we joke that you're a film evangelist. Well, I am too. That's really what it's about, man, is going out and watching films. Like, that's, to me, there's nothing, I don't know, nothing can hit me quite like movies can. So.
Nothing. And we're big sports heads, at least for me. I'll speak for myself.
Me too.
I love sports, but they still don't hit the same way for me as movies.
Music is close.
Music's really close.
But it's not quite there because it doesn't have all the senses. So
movies have it all.
They got it all, man. They got it all. Okay. Well, thanks for listening to the Tame Aperture Podcast. We appreciate you joining us for this breakdown of the Deer Hunter. Until next time, it's Gabe and Alan signing out.
The Tame Aperture Podcast is produced by Dutch Angle Pictures in association with Studio B Productions. Listen, watch, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and YouTube.